Hi, and welcome to Detox, Talks the Detox, a podcast where we talk to some of the world's finest leaders about their detox rituals and how they maintain continuity in a world of noise and chaos. How they make sure that the criticism that the world puts on them doesn't affect their insight and they still continue to perform as well as they do. Thanks for tuning in. This is Kunal Sundiramani, and you are listening to Detox, Talks the Detox.
With Jason Pfeiffer on the podcast. Jason is the author of Built for Tomorrow, the editor-in-chief of The Entrepreneur Magazine, and an awesome human being. Thank you so much for making time, and welcome to Detox.
Oh, wow. What a nice intro. Thank you.
So, Jason, you've had done so many different things, and more than that, you've, through all of that, gone into history unlike anyone else, gone into times when people just did not believe in the future. Have you had anything that you also read into your own life and your growth to come at a point where you look at the future as a story and the history as a story that just links up together?
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, so what you're referencing, in case people don't know, Pessimist Archive is the old name of my podcast, which is now called Build for Tomorrow, just like the book. And it was very focused on history and how we resist new things. And I was trying to understand why the things that are we come to see as so beneficial to our world were once seen as really detrimental to it. And that's everything from cars to bicycles to, you know, electricity to whatever. So have I experienced that myself? I mean, I try to keep my gut instincts in check, in which when I see something that I don't understand or like or see value in, that I try to remember that I am stuck in time and place a little bit. For example, I have a 7-year-old and he loves watching dudes on YouTube play video games. And that doesn't make any sense to me at all. I don't understand the appeal of it. And then when I see a video that he's watching that have been watched 35 million times, I just feel frustrated with the world. Like, why are people into this? But I also then try to remember that, number one, I watched a lot of what I'm sure was pretty dumb entertainment when I was a kid. So I turned out okay. It's all okay. But then also that I am not looking at this from the perspective of just holistic review of entertainment and the evolution of video. I'm looking at this as a 42-year-old dad who is too old to enjoy whatever the thing is that my 7-year-old is enjoying. And therefore, it would be foolish for me to dismiss it instead of to understand it. So I try to check that, but I understand that I feel in myself this natural thing that we all feel, which is that when we see something that doesn't appeal to us, we naturally assume that it is bad or wrong, and that it reminds us of our own mortality, because clearly the world has moved on and we're stuck with the things that we liked as a kid. And that's a scary and uncomfortable realization.
I think so. I think mortality, it's complicated how deep mortality is. I think it's the perfect example of the Dunning-Kruger effect, that you feel that you know a lot about mortality until you go deep in, and then you realize that, oh wow, it's just an ocean filled with so much more. It's one of those, my favorite philosophical concepts that I never can get over. It scares me every day and still excites me every day.
Yeah, there are some people who really build the idea of mortality into the way that they think about the world. And Matt Higgins, who just wrote a book called Burn the Boats, is very into that. He has some object from some culture that's about mortality, and he keeps it on his desk and he talks about it a lot. And I'm not there. I find mortality to be something that I would prefer to put off to the side. But what I am grateful for is that the world refreshes, that we have an opportunity, because we all are going to die off, for the next generation to start to define things themselves, which means that they're at least partially free from the beliefs and the limiting beliefs and the insistences of the generation that came before, and they get to revise and shape the world. and then just be criticized by the next generation for their own views. But that's how we get to progress, is by being able to pass things down from one generation to the next.
So taking a step back, overall, through all the different phases you've been at Men's Magazine, all these changes, jumping to entrepreneur, heading as the editor-in-chief, working on a book, building a podcast, mm-hmm. all these different stages beyond all everything that you talk about, what's your journey been like? What have been those moments in the rearview mirror where everything was blurry, but now make the best stories?
Well, you know, so it's a funny thing in that our memory... I'll give you a little lesson. Who am I to give lessons? But I can share this thing that I share a lesson that somebody who actually can give lessons gave me about how memory works, because learning this really helped me understand my own recollections of things, and therefore the story that I tell myself about my own experiences. So, okay, a couple things to know about memory. And this comes from this guy, Philippe de Bergard at Duke University. And I interviewed him and some other folks for a podcast I did a long time ago about memory. And he said, okay, so the first couple of things you have to understand. Number one is that your brain does not work and is not even designed to work the way that the microphones that we're using right now are, right? Our microphones are designed to capture on a second-by-second basis what's happening, and then to be able to reflect, well, not the microphones, but the storage system that's capturing the audio from the microphones, which in this case is Zoom, is capturing and then designed to replay in complete accuracy what had happened. Our brain is not designed to do that. That would be crazy. That would be a horrible thing, because it would mean that we could easily and instantly recall every experience, good and bad, and we'd feel those terrible things. Isn't it so good that you messed up 2, 5, 10, 20 years ago, and you don't viscerally feel that screw up every time that you think of it, if you think of it at all? This is on purpose. This is because our brains are designed to move us forward. There's something called the fading affect bias. Fading affect bias means that our brains retain the emotions associated with good memories longer than they retain the emotions associated with bad memories, which is to say that good memories can make us feel good in the future, whereas bad memories don't make us feel as bad in the future. That is by design, because again, if you took a risk and it didn't pay off and it was awful and excruciating, and every single time you took a risk after that, you felt what you felt the first time that risk didn't work, you would never take another risk. That would be limiting. It would inhibit our ability to grow. So our brains are designed to filter like that. Then one more thing to know, which is that this recording, it's being captured and then it can be replayed over and over again, start to finish linearly. Our brains don't record memories like that. So when you have an experience, it kind of gets stored in your brain, but it gets stored in fragments, in a million little fragments. And any memory. And then every time that you remember it, what you actually do is that you reassemble all these little fragments into one coherent memory. But there are pieces missing because you can't store it all. So Philippe described it kind of like a paleontologist putting together a dinosaur bone that's been shattered. Pieces are missing. Now, the paleontologist will fill those gaps in with the best knowledge that the paleontologist has about how this dinosaur was constructed. But we, of course, don't do that. So what do we do? How do we fill in the gaps in our memory? The answer is that our memory, the parts of our brain that are associated with memory, are very closely associated with the parts of our brain associated with imagination. We imagine the gaps. And so we have this memory that's faulty that we then fill in gaps with imagination and then experience it as a true memory. And that becomes the narrative that we tell of ourselves. And the reason I tell you all that in response is that, you know, when I think back on my own career, I have all these stories of what made me, but I also spend a lot of time wondering how true those stories are, or how much of them are versions of the experience that I have over years turned into a narrative that is only partially resembling what actually happened, but became this narrative that really helps me understand myself. And this, I think, is what we all do. And it's not bad or wrong, but it's worth remembering.
That's a very counterintuitive perspective. Like, I was talking to a guest the other day, and we just came to the conclusion that everything that is correct or influential in our lives is always counterintuitive. And that is what becomes intuitive after a certain point of time.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that there's a truth to that, because every great product was counter to, in some way, the way that we were doing things before. I mean, what is disruption if not an undercutting of current expectations and assumptions? So yeah, I think that's right. Which is maybe why I'm so attracted to counterintuitive thinking.
So personally talking, any point in life which you feel was even filled up with imagination still is something that every time you come up with a new challenge today, it just flashes back. If you come up with a rough patch today, you get a call, Jason, there's a big fire. I think the call you get every day, there's a big fire. Yeah. What's that? And when the fire keeps spreading, what's that one memory, even if it's filled up with imaginations, that comes to your rescue and does its purpose?
Huh? You mean like a fire at work? Not a
fire at work. Yeah.
Not a fire in a building. yeah. Well, okay. So I learned a really important lesson when I was at I was at Men's Health. It was my first national magazine job. I just moved to New York for it, and I was 28 years old. This is 2008. And at some point, I can't remember the exact location. I should know this because this is kind of national politics. But anyway, Barack Obama was running for president, and the editor in chief of the magazine at the time, his name was Dave Zinczenko, decided to put him on the magazine cover. And so Obama was on the magazine cover, and this was very last minute. And as a result, we had to scramble the whole staff to kind of rearrange some of the magazine. And nobody ever explained to me where this edict came from, but there was a decision to be made, which was that because Obama was on the cover of the magazine, we had to soften any descriptions about sex in the magazine. Now, one doesn't really have anything to do with the other, but I don't know what it was. I mean, I guess maybe someone on Obama's team was concerned about the amount of sex. I don't know. I don't know who this came from or why this happened. It's never made any sense to me. But anyway, it fell to me because I was editing a section in the magazine that always had a couple like sex tip stories, you know, Men's Health. And I had to, at the very last second, I mean, the magazine was like going to the printer. I had to spend hours going through all these pages and coming up with ways to softly say things like how do you not use the term phone sex, but talk about phone sex? Like, how do you do that? And I spent hours, and they were going back and forth with me, and they send it to somebody else who would send it to somebody else, and they come back to me and they're like, that's still too risque or whatever. And anyway, it was a crazy night. And then afterwards, my boss was really happy with me, because I had handled this weird crisis. Somebody had to do it, and it was me. I was the one at the office till midnight doing this stupid thing. And I have forever thought that I am fortunate when something goes wrong. Because when something goes wrong, then I can be the hero. Look, if nothing goes wrong, then that's good. But that also means that there's no opportunity to stand out, to be recognized for fixing something. And people really, really like when you fix something. And so that's what I think about now, is every time that there's some kind of fire, I in a way flash back to that ridiculous thing with Obama and the sex pages, because it was the first big lesson that I learned in my career about how valuable it can be to be in the wrong place at the right time.
So when things go wrong, our natural tendency as a human is fight or flight. So
yeah,
when things are going wrong, and it can get really overwhelming when something's just going wrong, especially when you're in the middle of it and stuff is going, how do you keep yourself detoxed? Because I think when things are going wrong and it gets overwhelming, just the fact that things are going wrong takes up so much mental space that you don't have enough mental space left to make it right. So how do you detox yourself when everything is going wrong to be able to get enough mental space to make sure it doesn't go wrong? Yes.
But so I think that the reason that giant problems feel overwhelming is because you can't see the solution to them. And you can't see the solution to them because there is no one solution to a giant problem. A giant problem is a collection of smaller problems. And so the first thing that you need to do is just start to pick it apart. And that's what I tend to do. There's a big thing going on. Okay, what are the components of this problem? What does that person actually want? What would solve that thing over there? And this is what I've heard over and over again from leaders who have faced enormous challenges. I remember one of the first really interesting conversations I had along these lines was with Jason Robbins, who's the founder of DraftKings. And that, you know, so DraftKings was a pioneer. And I mean, let's just, they wouldn't call it gambling, but it's gambling. And I don't really remember exactly how they started to exist, but it sort of was a loophole in anti-gambling laws or whatever. And so as they grew really large, the attorneys general of New York and Massachusetts started to make some serious grumbles about changing the law in a way that basically would just put DraftKings out of existence. And I was talking to Jason much later about how he managed that, because that's an existential problem for his business. That is literally the ground that his business is built upon. And so I said, well, how did you manage that? Because that's a huge issue and it's not really in your control. And he said, well, look, every problem is just a problem, right? It's like, it's not like some problems are not, that no problems are supernatural or beamed down from Mars or created by a monster that comes out of the sea. We're like, there, it's all just it's a problem. So, okay, if it's a problem, a big problem, but if it's a problem, then the thing that needs to be done next is, how do we solve this? All right, well, what are the components of this problem? How do I build towards a solution? Now for him, he's like, all right, well, this is problematic. This is existing in an ecosystem that is not mine. So we're going to need to get some people who understand law and have relationships with lawmakers. And we're also going to have to start digging into the regulations that exist and maybe start proposing some regulations that would satisfy what these people are looking for, but at the same time, allow us to exist. And he just started structuring it out that way. And now it was long and it required a lot of work, but they got it done. And I try to remember that every problem is just a problem, or at least a series of problems. And you get lost, not because it's a big problem, but because you can't immediately see how to start building towards a solution. So start breaking it down and then you will.
Break it down. I love that, because it's just scary when a problem's going wrong, because you first need to just detox from focusing on that to solve it. Breaking it down, that's so well said.
Thanks.
Simplicity at its best.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's no reason to make things more complicated. Things are already complicated enough.
I love what Albert Einstein said. You don't understand something well enough unless you can explain it to a 5-year-old.
Yeah, well, that's true. There, you know, I mean, you learn versions of that wherever you go. Something that I've learned in magazine editing, for example, is that when I started as a, you know, it's like when I go back to Men's Health, when I worked at Men's Health, I was a front of book editor, which is a term in magazines for usually a junior editor who edits what's called the front of book section. So this in the very beginning of the magazine, there are all these pages with like kind of little items. That's called the front of book. And you know, those items are sometimes very short. Sometimes you got to tell a story in 50 words. It's all you got, a little sidebar or something. And you know, the first draft that you write is 250 words. And you're like, oh, well, I need more space. But you know what? You don't get more space. You get 50 words. So then you got to cut it down. And what you end up discovering is that you can communicate a lot in a small amount. And actually, it's better because it forces you to be incredibly economical about the language that you use. One of the challenges that I think young writers today will face is that because so many of them are writing for the web, most of them are writing for the web, and the web doesn't have a word count limit, that they can go on and on and on, and they aren't forced to tighten their language in the way that I was forced to tighten my language. Now, this is not a like generation thing. Like, you can do it and you can learn that. And I think that everyone should. Tighter web stories are still better than longer web stories. But, you know, the physical constraint definitely helped me. And it taught me that sometimes, I mean, the cliche is less is more, but it is true.
Love that. So what about change? You had so many changes jumping from one place to the other. When change has a very similar effect to a large problem. It overwhelms you and takes more mental space, leaving you without enough mental space to deal with the actual change. Yeah. What's your framework for that?
Well, recognize what change is like for you. And the answer is that change is loss. That's the problem, is that you're feeling like you're experiencing change as loss because you're identifying something that you had that you are now losing access to. And therefore, you are losing something. And our instinct, our human instinct, is loss aversion. And this is decades of psychological research backing this up. We are far more concerned with protecting against loss than we are in identifying gain. So you are seeing a change, you're experiencing it as loss, then you're extrapolating that loss because you're thinking, well, if I lose this, then I'm going to lose that. And if I lose that, then I'm going to lose that other thing. And it starts to get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And if you can catch yourself in that, then you can start to question the losses, a lot of which are based on assumptions. You don't know that you're going to lose this thing, or you also don't know what you're going to gain as a result that might complement the old thing or might, frankly, substitute for it. And that's the first thing that I try to do, is just recognize the experience that I'm having and see how it doesn't need to be that way.
I absolutely love that. That is so deep and so practical at the same time. That's a rare combination.
it's what I want to go for. Sometimes that you don't have to get crazy complicated in order to step back and reevaluate, right? Sometimes it's just a matter of identifying the thing that is happening inside of you. And once you recognize that, you can start to unpack all the reactions that you're having as a result of it. And then you can backtrack to some kind of more rational action.
So this huge thing written on my wall, a quote by Steve Jobs that goes, "Simplicity is the ultimate sophistication."
Mm-hmm.
And I adore it. It's something I want to remind myself often because it's just so easy to forget.
Yeah.
And especially like, I think even in business, you just, a niche looks like, you just try expanding beyond your niche even before you've captured your niche. It's
right.
Just keep it simple until you just can't keep it simple, and then find more ways to make it simpler.
You know, I was just writing about simplicity in a way because I rebrand. I have a newsletter which is called, as of now, it's called One Thing Better. But I say as of now because we're talking on a Monday and I announced the change yesterday. So it was pretty new. The newsletter had a different branding before. And I always just found it complicated to explain the newsletter. Like, what is it and what is it for and who is it for? And the more time that I spent trying to grapple with this and like, why is this newsletter not growing fast enough? And the more I started talking to really smart people who are in sales or who are in content, I realized that I was being too complicated and I needed to simplify what the product was and who it was for. And so I wrote this newsletter about the changing of my newsletter. And for what it's worth, if anyone's interested, you can find this at jasonpfeiffer.com/newsletter.
We linked it
in. Yeah. I shared this framework, which I'll just share with you now, from a sales coach named Myron Golden, who I just happened to interview a couple of years ago. And he said that he believes everyone should describe themselves with four qualities. And it's a really interesting breakdown. So here it is. Number one, it must be measurable, which is to say it must contain an exact quantifiable thing. Number two, it must be statable. So it should be fit. It should fit into a short sentence. Number three, it must be understandable. So clear language, avoiding any confusion. And then number four, it must be desirable, containing something that people already want. And you know, he told me, he was like, look, people will say I'm a doctor or a mechanic, but that doesn't tell anybody whether or not you are for them. And he said, I'll just read this quote from him because I really liked it. He said, people can only decide whether or not they want to do business with you based on the fact that they hear what you say. And then they think, I need that, or I don't need that. You want to be one of those two reasons. It's like, hate me or celebrate me, but whatever you do, don't just tolerate me because I'm confusing. That really landed with me. I thought about that a lot, and it's, you know, it's ultimately where the newsletter One Thing Better came from, because it, as you can see, it's kind of designed with that focus in mind.
That is incredibly deep. That is... I think I'm in a different philosophical realm all of a sudden. I tend to end up going there more often than not. But I think it's great. It gives you a chance to reset and just refocus into a different level.
Yeah. And it clarifies your purpose, and therefore what you're making makes it easier. I think it's going to be an easier newsletter to write, frankly, than the previous one. But also it clarifies for the audience why they should care. I go, you know, if somebody doesn't know why they should care, they are certainly not going to care.
What about, so we spoke a lot about change. Like when a today, if there's another change that comes up, what's your self-talk? Not a personal change, but an external change, something happening like a pandemic.
Oh. Well, what's my self-talk? I mean, you know, I have this little framework in the book, which came out of my self-talk, which is like these three questions, which is one, what new thing is happening? Number two, what new habit or skill are we learning as a result? And then number three, how could that be put to good use? And it's not to say that I'm going to know the answer. I mean, pandemic, I didn't know the answer, but I started to formulate some answers, and I was very interested in watching how other people got to their answers. And I was ultimately trying to locate some kind of benefit and gain so that I could start to engage with it that way. Right. I mean, I remember the very first version of this that I thought about in the pandemic, like, you know, just like the day things were starting to shut down, you saw panic everywhere, was I just realized I'm in a position as just someone who has some kind of platform, I'm in a position to be helpful to people, and people are going to need that more than ever now. They're going to need voices that are instructive. And I don't really know what to say right now, but I know that it's an opportunity if I can figure it out, if I can figure out what I have to say about this. And it took some adjusting. The first thing I did is I just kind of shared in everybody's, you know, kind of lives being turned upside down, and was sharing my own version of that. And then was talking to a lot of people and trying to find some patterns and share it. And that turned out to be the right instinct, because I became more relevant to people and more opportunities opened up. And there's just a version of that all the time in any change.
Moving to the rapid fire round, couple quick questions, answer them in the least possible time.
Okay.
Apples or oranges?
Oranges.
Apple or Android?
Apple.
Mac or Windows?
Mac.
One piece of advice that is given very often but shouldn't be?
Write what you know. Write what you know sounds like you're supposed to pause and just only write what you already have. But no, I think that what you do is you go out and you learn more, and then you share as you learn.
Your favorite music artist?
I don't have one right now, but I'll tell you the people who like made a real difference to me as a kid, Green Day, and the Weaker Thans, and Ben Folds Five. That was my power trio as a kid.
The best advice you have received?
Don't be afraid to ask dumb questions.
One piece of advice that should be given more often?
You can't screw this up.
Your favorite book?
The first book that made a significant difference to me was a book called A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius by Dave Eggers. It's a memoir, but I read it in college and it just shattered my understanding of what the limits of writing were. And it made me want to be a more ambitious writer.
Your favorite web series?
Is Succession on HBO. I think it's just dynamite. And I can't wait for the next season.
One piece of advice that just keeps coming back and you just see it work out every time you get a chance. You just see one piece of advice that you're able to use more often than any.
You know, it's a cliche that your weaknesses can be your strengths, but it's a that's a core element of stories that I hear all the time from incredibly successful people.
Your favorite place in the world?
Well, you know, I live in Brooklyn, New York, and I love Brooklyn, New York. So, but of course, I take Brooklyn, New York for granted because I'm just here every day. So I could say Brooklyn. I will also say that I've been to Berlin 3 times and I adore it. And if I had a weird parallel life, that parallel life would be me living in Berlin.
Something that you stumbled upon, but you just can't get over. It can be an electronic device, anything except your phone or your car and your AirPods.
Can't get over it in a positive way? Like, I just love it?
Anything, positive, negative, just something that just takes up so much space, mentally or physically.
Ugh. 2 days ago, I was in bed just flipping around on TikTok, which I don't do that often. And I came across this, like, I don't know what the hell it was. It was like a medical video. It was like a video. Somebody had a growth on the inside of their thigh, and there was like a doctor. He was like measuring it and putting cream on it. And I watched it for way too long, waiting for something to happen. And I cannot get that horrible image out of my head. Like, I really can't. I've been touching my thigh lately to just like remind myself that like my thigh doesn't have that on it. It's horrible. And so my lesson is, like, whenever I see gross things on TikTok, I am just flipping as fast as I can.
That is well said. Thank you so much for making time. This was such a privilege.
Yeah, no, thanks. It was fun.
You just heard an episode on the Detox Podcast. Do not forget to subscribe on your favorite streaming platform, whether it is Spotify or iTunes. We are there.